Welcome back to Reflections, your host Jorge Gonzalez. And in the first segment, I was talking about this book called From the Bar, and Black Angus Bar, Confessions of the Bartender. And in terms of some of the things that weren't really quite legal, he also explains that every once in a while there a chaos would develop. The security guards were really enjoyed, you know, getting involved in problems with you know, people who were not being orderly, and things would really get chaotic, or there would be a raid, which incidentally, when there was a raid, there, according to him, and they knew that they would be coming. Instead of 50 prostitutes, there'd be about, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 of them, and everybody was, you know, they could tell that that was gonna, you could tell that that was gonna be a night raid, and but when this chaos took place, either because of the raid or because of, you know, disorderly and everybody getting shouting and this and that and people leaving, and all, there was a lot of the patrons there would put, and kind of showing off, would put money and you know, in front of them right there on the bar. And when the chaos took place, the bartenders would take the money, and you know, so I you know, going back to, you know, page 25, and speaking about himself, he says, yo le tenía confianza, he was his uncle, y él a mí, no solo porque yo fuera familia, sino porque sabía cómo yo era, inteligente, bueno con los números, bilingüe, pero sobre todo honesto, incapaz de robar o de hacer algo incorrecto. Eso, en un negocio donde el dinero circula sin parar, vale más que cualquier diploma. So he says he had confidence, his uncle, who was the owner, in him, and not only because he was a family member, but that he was intelligent, he was good with numbers, bilingual, and especially he was honest and capable of stealing or doing anything incorrect. And that was really important when in a business where money was rampant, and it was more important than a diploma. Well, you know, as he tells some of the stories, it wasn't all you know, that illegal and all, and throughout, I mean, he kind of emphasizes that it was considered a legitimate business, and the prostitutes, from according to him, which he says, I'm not ingenuous and all, but the ones who talked were clear that this was because they wanted to be that they considered it a legitimate and a business. In fact, there was one prostitute that a Mexican and had the La Virgen de Guadalupe and a medal, and said that she always prayed before doing her business. He says that the when they would do their business, he said they'd just say, well, we'll be right back, and they come back very nonchalantly, and he says it was like somebody delivering a pizza, you know, coming back, and they did their job with the good delivery and the warm pizza. It's, you know, he has these sayings that are, you gotta smile. The tremendous diversity of the clients, and he talks about tips. He says that the Puerto Rican tippers were the worst. The American and internationals were the best. And he says the Canadians didn't seem to understand the concept. So I guess they were worse than the Puerto Ricans. They just were kind of a little bit of loss of what should be done in that regard. But he was telling that, you know, the tips was really the critical thing, that they were paid below it would allow them to in the tourist industry. And this was, you know, a restaurant and a hotel and a bar, you know, at the and it was run like that, and all. So In terms of stories about the process, it was these college students came in and they started laughing and looking at these two girls that were very, very young and very good looking. And later they told the bartender, what's this? He says, those are two students in our class. So there's all these kinds of stories and all, which, you have to laugh. But the more serious part, is his story. And it goes in, with my definition of well-being, of the personal values, a sense of self-satisfaction and peace. And his story, he's not there that long. Incidentally, the Black Angus fades away not because of any illegal crime or income tax evasion or any of that sort. It's basically, he says, because of urban renewal with Governor Rosselló and the Triángulo Dorado and the convention, and those things were just taken away because of urban renewal. But in terms of his story, there is double face, because I think there was a lot of immorality. I mean, of course, with the prostitutes, a tremendous immorality. But in terms of the business, I mentioned some of the illegalities. There's a story if somebody would ask for Johnny Walker Black, they would give some other generic scotch, and they would argue. And that if the person said this doesn't taste as well, but there was one night where this person came in and really insisted that this was not Johnny Walker Black label scotch, and in fact they got a little bit fussy, and he said, "Well, I want to talk to the manager," and when the manager came, he showed him some calling card, and the manager took him away. I asked for the Johnny Walker, and asked for one of the prostitutes to come along, and they went off into what they called the VIP room, and things were settled there. Later on, it turns out that this was apparently a representative of Johnny Walker, and it created the supposed problems, and it was fixed. Like sometimes things get fixed, but going back, he tells that all of a sudden he started feeling uncomfortable and he couldn't pin it down. And it wasn't because of, he says moral and all his, and it wasn't because he wasn't doing well economically and all, although there are chapters and wordings there where people were telling him that, he wasn't going to get rich. Of course, I think he became a journalist, a communicator, so I don't think he ever ended up being a rich person. But he says that eventually it wasn't a moral issue, and I'm quoting now page 15, not a moral issue, nor one of shame, but for emotional survival. He says he couldn't put his finger on why he was feeling uncomfortable. He says as he's dressing the normal uniform that he had to put on for this job as a bartender, but that it felt like a different skin, and he tells how he eventually on first of all Christmas Eve, he for the first time he didn't show up, and then he did go on Christmas Day and went through the whole duty that he normally had, and at 4 o'clock in the morning at that time, he took the second shift. He went to the general manager and told him that this was his last night. The manager didn't try to persuade him differently. He says, "Well, okay, we'll work out whatever we finally owe you during the course of the week." And he got in his car and he felt completely relieved, but crying, and he said he felt he saw kind of a figure in the back of the seat, back seat, and felt something, you know, nails kind of grasping at his neck, said, you know, you can't leave. And he said, I'm leaving. And it sounds like he says this is the first time he told this story. And he finally got home. I think he, you know, he lived in Corozal, and cried in his bed. It was a very traumatic ending to the book and to his days at the Black Angus. So that figure in the back that kind of felt he was being attacked was the devil. And it's pretty clear that little by little his real his personal values were being affected, and he no longer felt satisfied, and he no longer felt in peace with his life, and he broke away, that's the last chapter of the book, and he ends up by saying, I nunca volví al Black Angus, ni como cliente ni para llevar a nadie. Ese día murió el Black Angus y nací yo. I never went back to Black Angus, neither as a client nor to take anyone. On that day, Black Angus died and I was born. We can buy it in English. Read Spanish, and if this led you to get in, you know, interested in the story, so be it. But it has a meaning, right, for our well-being. I think it's interesting. Okay, so the second, that was the first strike. It wasn't the Black Angus, Tony Tiercy, and what brought it to the dead. It was Tony Tiercy was with La Riviera, and the Black Angus was something else. Then the second strike I mentioned at the beginning was the Trump Xi meeting in Beijing, and I had mentioned that I thought not much was going to be done, maybe some trade deals. And nothing was going to really happen with Taiwan. They would, you know, say that they talked about it. They were, you know, what's the word that they use? Frank discussions, I think, is the term the diplomats use. But I was wrong. She, from the very beginning, was very upfront that Taiwan was important. And he cited Thucydides' trap, which he cited with respect to Taiwan. And this was an ancient historian of the Peloponnesian War with Sparta and Athens. And he cited that sometimes the second strongest was challenging the first, and the first then starts the war to impede that happening, and apparently, you know, that was a 20-year war with Sparta and Athens, and Chi was pretty good. He says, you know, pretty clear is the word. He says, quoting, and they put it out as a report. So it is, the Taiwan question is the most important issue in China-U.S. relations, and I'm quoting. It says, if it is handled properly, the bilateral relationship will enjoy overall stability. Otherwise, the two countries will have clashes and even conflicts, putting the entire relationship into great jeopardy. That was pretty strong statement by Xi. And the other thing that happened there is the U.S. and Trump had to approve $11 billion weapon sales to Taiwan, and Trump came back and said he was reconsidering that, had to make a decision. So I was wrong. the Taiwan was a socket to them, and I've always been, you know, when this Iran war, I always was a little bit concerned, and what Trump, you know, the Dunro Doctrine with Latin America, that China can use that same doctrine in the Asia Pacific area. So I was wrong. It was stronger than I imagined. Of course, you know, China said that they was in favor of opening the Straits of Hormuz, which we knew that was going to happen, and against the toll. But you know, that was open before the Iran war. It's not like the Iran war was done in order to open the Straits of Hormuz. It's what, you know, caused the closing. So, and China, you know, has also said it's against Iran having the nuclear weapon. That's been there forever. China was part of the deal with the United States and United Kingdom and Russia and France for that 2015, you know, Iran agreement. And that was, you know, against Iran agreed that it was not going to be developing nuclear weapons. So that's never been really on the table. And Iran still says it's not going to be up on nuclear weapons. That's not an issue. So China's saying it's not in favor. Don't have to make a trip to Beijing for that kind of a statement. So, you know, what's going to happen? It's a chess game. There's an article by the Atlantic, and it's, you know, it's titled "Checkmate in Iran." And but some people, you know, understand that if the U.S. Starts rebombing and getting more military thing, that Iran will capitulate. Others think it will not. So it's a tough bind that our friend the President of the United States has gotten himself into. And I don't know. I do know that Iran is a tough cookie, and it's going to continue to be a tough cookie. That war should not have been started. That's my strong belief, and I hope I'm wrong. Okay. And then in Ukraine, I run out of time in the second segment. Talk a little bit about Ukraine and where that stands, and then we'll move to the third mistake, strike that I had with respect to bringing the litigation cases back, removing them back to the local government. So we'll be back right after the pause. This is Jorge Gonzalez, your host, Reflections.